Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour,
can worker-owned cooperatives transform workers' lives and livelihoods?
But first, we will explore the importance of Black women intellectuals, the way in which they have framed the scholarship, the analysis, and policies to overcome white supremacy as well as male supremacy with Ashley Farmer of the University of Texas, Austin. Civil rights, Black empowerment, and confronting structural racism and sexism have seen their profile risen in the past few years. The murder of George Floyd at the hands of police raised the profile even greater and called for a true reckoning in the United States. But these issues are not new. They are entrenched in the American experience. But analysis of their efforts and what must be done to promote social justice and equality have varied remarkably throughout the history of the nation. And in particular, Black women have advanced a unique and brilliant challenge within this discourse in promoting justice and overcoming white and male supremacy. On today's show, we will discuss the essential women who have intellectually challenged the predominant norms of racism and sexism within the nation. Our guest is Ashley Farmer, Associate Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies and History at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Remaking Black Power, How Black Women Transformed an Era, and co-editor of New Perspectives on the Black Intellectual Tradition. She's also the co-editor and curator of the Black Power series with Ibram X. Kendi. Professor Farmer, thank you very much for joining us today. Your research has focused on Black women intellectuals, the way that they've raised these issues. In what ways have Black women differed from other authors, particularly Black men, at their analysis and their approach to a number of these issues?
Like you said, I'm really interested in how Black women, particularly in the 1960s and 70s, who would consider themselves Black power activists or civil rights activists, have looked around the world, thought about their oppression, and tried to come up with different analyses or ways in which could be different. And I think there's a couple of key ways that they converge with Black men on this front and a couple of key ways they diverge. First is that they're interested in the total liberation of Black people, right? That means not always necessarily just entry into, say, a body politic or entry into a particular class or entry into a set of jobs, but really talking about the liberation of Black people in all forms. That means certainly the ability to move, the ability to be housed anywhere, the ability to have different kinds of jobs, but also the ability to kind of be unbridled by the stereotypes or the confines of white supremacy. So I think that is something that they were very united in their goal in. But sometimes their approach or their scope to that was really different. So what I've discovered from my research is that many Black women, while they organized alongside Black men, found their analyses limiting in terms of sexism. And so kind of their catchphrase or their way of thinking about it was always that they said that they were content to kind of overthrow racism and capitalism, but leave patriarchy in place. And so a lot of what you see Black women that I talk about in my book doing, and these are women in the Panther Party, these are women that are part of, you know, Afrocentric groups, et cetera, is saying, if you're really talking about liberation, if you really want to talk about a whole scale upending of society and reformulating it, you can't leave Black women behind. And more specifically, that we experience racism and sexism and class inequality and sexual identification inequality differently because we're women. And so they really did push men to kind of further that critique. And sometimes they were able to do it from within organizations. And sometimes they felt they had to separate out and kind of organize, you know, outside of what we consider mixed sex organizations to make that happen.
Do you have some specific examples of ways in which this intersectionality, you know, dealing with both sexism and racism would play out in a number of these issues?
One thing would be the kinds of things that they wanted these groups to support, right? So, you know, something where somebody was engaged in an issue of police brutality was a no-brainer for most of these groups, or something where somebody was a victim of job discrimination or housing discrimination was a no-brainer. But what happened when somebody was a victim of rape? Or what happens when somebody was, you know, being attacked for the way that they looked, particularly their hair and their dress as a woman, because they weren't living up to different standards of beauty? They really wanted to make sure that they were mobilizing Black power groups around these very same issues, just as they were mobilizing around issues that were considered Black issues, but really often affected or were kind of figureheaded by Black men, police brutality, for example, being a really big one. A great example of how this played out across the board was a woman named Joanne Little. Joanne Little was a teenager who was incarcerated through, you know, kind of the criminal justice system, as it were, and the jailer attempted to rape her, a white man, and she killed him and she fled. So this kind of got at the intersection of class politics, of women's rights, of the prison industrial complex and abolition. And it was a moment when Black power groups and civil rights groups really tried to come around her. And I think in large part because of that, she was exonerated because it was proven that this jailer had a kind of a history of this. And so, you know, that became a Black power issue in a way that you wouldn't think it would be because of women's pushing that forward.
Absolutely. Now, the subtitle is, you know, how Black women transformed an era. The era, you know, the civil rights movement is largely my understanding of what you're describing. How much, you know, has this focus really been on the civil rights movement, the role that Black women have played versus throughout history, and in particular throughout the modern history of the United States, throughout the 20th century, at least, women have played a pretty substantial role, but they really haven't been written into the history. In what ways is the civil rights era different than, say, you know, the 20s, you know, during a period where we saw activism, and, you know, during the 40s, where we saw a period of activism?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of key differences. So, I mean, you know, women are, I want to emphasize in all parts of this history, women, and particularly Black women, are really at every phase of a movement, from kind of intellectual development to rank and file organizing, to leadership, to fundraising. And that's no different in the civil rights and Black power era. But what was perhaps a little bit unique or kind of historically specific about this particular time is that they are also organizing within the context of a larger women's movement of the 1960s and 70s, sometimes what we call the women's liberation movement. And although this is largely seen as a white women's movement because it was focused on issues that often didn't think about how race mediated or kind of intersected with gender concerns, I do think that it offered the space for more women to become leaders. It offered spaces for more women to publish and talk about issues related to what they were concerned about, their gender-specific issues, even if they were considered, you know, they wouldn't consider themselves feminist or part of the women's liberation movement. So I think that's one thing. Another thing is that this was a great moment for the radical Black press. Now, the Black press has obviously existed since the days of slavery, but advances in printing and cost of printing and kind of circulation and globalization made it so that almost every group could print something and that it could be circulated both in the United States and globally. And if women weren't often the figureheads or the people giving the speeches at rallies, they were often writing in these publications and sometimes editing and producing these publications. So that was another way that they could really talk about and get their ideas out, particularly their ideas about what roles women should play, issues that they felt were specific, like anti-rape activism or birth control activism, we see a lot. So I think that those are two differences that help kind of spur this moment for Black women's organizing and really help them put their ideas and priorities at the forefront of the movement.
Yeah, when we think of the leaders of Black liberation, particularly in the civil rights era, we usually turn to the speeches, the, you know, the writings, the messages delivered by people like, you know, like Malcolm X, you know, Frantz Fanon internationally, Stokely Carmichael, and of course, Martin Luther King. First, who are some of the women that should be a part of this pantheon and asserting this is not an either or, but to be able to add, you know, to the list of voices to fully understand the ideology, the thought that goes behind the calls for reform in the civil rights movement?
I want to uplift two different women. The first is Ella Baker. For those who don't know, Ella Baker was a lifelong activist, probably most known for being the executive secretary of King's SCLC, and then eventually being kind of the godmother and intellectual advisor of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, was responsible for a large amount of the student sit-ins of the early 1960s, and then moved into securing voting rights as the 60s developed. So because of them, we have the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 64 and 65. And so what people, there's not a lot about Baker besides a biography, which we can talk about when we talk about resources, but also she was a prolific writer. She'd been organizing since the 1940s and 50s during the Depression. She'd worked for the NAACP before, you know, working for King. And she also was a great speaker. And so there are speeches and videos of her circulated. She has a wonderful text called Bigger Than a Hamburger, which really tries to contextualize why students were using the lunch counter as a site to kind of start or kick off the civil rights movement. And even though we kind of always read King's, you know, I Have a Dream speech, I think the Bigger Than the Hamburger speech should go alongside that as kind of a key example. And there's many more. And one of my favorite things, though, that she said is that strong people don't need strong leaders. And that was kind of her central moral philosophy. So you don't see her always out front in the same ways. But if you talk to any activist during this period of time, no one doesn't say that she was transformative in helping them think about how they should organize and what their goals were and how to be a student of this.
If I can follow up before that second, because I think that story of Ella Baker is really fascinating, because in my own understanding of the civil rights movement, there seems to be this divide between the focus on a handful of truly eloquent, you know, brilliant leaders like Martin Luther King, and that being the emphasis of the movement, as opposed to you referenced SNCC and how much of the civil rights movement were really individuals willing to risk their own physical security, you know, risk their health, risk being beaten by integrating lunch counters. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, that approach, that sort of big leader approach, is a bit of a masculinist approach. You know, let's find the big man, celebrate, almost create a kind of heroic vision. And while there's true greatness with those leaders, this de-emphasis on the common everyday person going out there doing their part and risking quite a bit, you know, with that. Would you agree that's more of a masculinist approach, and the idea of a much more participatory approach tends to fall a bit more under a feminist rubric?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's no secret that patriarchy frames both the existence of these organizations and the ways that we write about them, right? So, I mean, we certainly, the history of all things, but in particular, kind of Black organizing this way starts with, you know, kind of the great man, then it might go to an organization, then it might trickle down to the women, right? But really, I think what we should think about it as is more of an iceberg, where there's always work going on underneath, and then something is the catalyst that pushes it above water. But typically, women are at the top of that, but also are functioning in all of those levels as well. And I think that it's a really a mistake on the part of both historians and those of us who teach this, because as long as you're teaching about this great heroic approach, and that can include, you know, King and Malcolm, but that can also include really great women. You know, I would say somebody like Angela Davis, right, is an example of that, is that their experiences are, and their level of bravery is unmatched, but it also seems so far away from what one person can do. Right. It's either though you have to be King or Malcolm or Angela, right? Or you're nobody. But when we talk about it in kind of a communal approach where we see each person doing their part differently, you start to see how you can engage and kind of move the needle forward collectively, even without kind of risking it all as they were, right? And some of those people, you know, somebody like Angela, for example, I mean, she didn't ask for any of that. She just kind of found herself in that situation, right? So we also should remember that not all of these people even, you know, anticipated that they would become kind of these martyrs or leaders that they are, just the historical moment thrust it onto that. So I do think that that's key, both for thinking more pervasively about a movement and the individuals, but also for looking at how, you know, we can find models for ourselves of how we want to engage. And Black women offer a lot of that, kind of working among the rank and file.
Well, you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ways in which Black women helped to frame the radicalism, the thought, the activism of the civil rights movement and throughout the movements of Black liberation with Ashley Farmer of the University of Texas, Austin. And I cut you off. You're going to give us a second name of somebody who would be, you know, a wonderful sort of recovery of the memory of some of these, you know, some of these great authors and, you know, and great speakers. So.
Yeah. So the other woman I wanted to left with is a woman named Audley Moore, sometimes called Queen Mother Moore, Queen Mother Audley Moore. And she is far less known, but equally as important. Just to give the briefest of background, she was born in 1898 and died in 1997. So basically lived a century. She began organizing in the 1920s. And her last kind of public appearance was in 1995 at the Million Man March, just to give you a scope of the level of organizing. Unlike Ella Baker, who had a college degree, Audley Moore only went through the third grade. But I would both consider them kind of what we would call organic intellectuals, meaning that they developed their political analyses and their writings from their actual experiences versus kind of formal schooling in that way. Queen Mother Moore was more on the radical side. She was interested in a form of separation for Black people and full Black political self-determination. But one of the things that she is most known for is for being the mother of the modern reparations movement. Beginning in the 1950s and throughout the 1990s, she really advocated, sometimes single-handedly and definitely on the margins, for the idea that Black people deserved repayment, and repayment could be an actual physical check, but repayment also could be symbolic, an apology, a monument, right? Policies, right? For not only all of our labor during enslavement, but also for the psychological and cultural and political effects of Jim Crow to the present, right? And she is a primary reason why, you know, today we actually have examples, particularly at the local level or at universities, of people trying to engage in ideas of reparation and repair. But she was a key kind of organizer of that. And she wrote about this. She wrote pamphlets in the 1960s talking about why reparations should happen, offering examples from international and national contexts of when reparations have been paid to wrong groups, and even offering examples of how we could do it, right? One of the things that I think is hardest for people to wrap around with reparations is it seems so enormous and it's so hard to track. How do you know, we kind of think of it as a 1-1 ratio. Did your family benefit? Should you pay? Was your family disadvantaged? Should you get money? And one of the things I think Moore really offered us is just examples to try, right? It's not cut and dry and easy, but she was often through her speeches and writings just saying, here's different ways we could do this. None of them are perfect, but at least we attempt to make amends. And so many organizers credit her with helping them understand early organizing of the 20th century, but also with understanding reparations. And I mean, organizers from, you know, lawyers like Charles Ogletree at Harvard to those grassroots organizers in Mississippi who are still organizing on behalf of this. So I think she's another great example of somebody which very little is written on, but really is kind of seeped into our intellectual consciousness in ways that we don't always understand.
I think that's a wonderful, you know, name, you know, to give all of us, and a reminder that the issue of reparations, again, was reinvigorated over the last, you know, few years. Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, famous essay that has had us talking, you know, for quite a bit about the nature of reparations, that this has been an idea that's been out there for actually rather a long time. And it's not an abstract idea. It's something that we could actually start thinking about some specifics. Do you have some examples? I mean, obviously one would be, you know, sending checks, but I also know with our emphasis on structural racism, is there a way that you could frame reparations? I know, for example, Kamala Harris had highlighted the issue about lending practices and Black home ownership, and framed it a bit as, addressing structural racism, but also a reparations question, you know, opening up lines of credit for home ownership. Are there other, examples, policy examples you might?
You know, Moore often suggested job programs as a way of kind of entering into the United States, and then, but also into the United States workforce, but also then giving people the opportunity to use those skills to build either within white society or separate from it. More recently, I would say that an example is Georgetown, the university. They have tried to track back those who would be the descendants of enslaved who were either sold in order to fund the university or also help kind of build the university and offered those folks monetary and also perhaps free tuition. We've seen local level city ordinances. I think Asheville is one example where not only are they offering just an apology for the ways in which they've discriminated to Black people in the past, but also putting aside funds of money to help, you know, with Black home ownership, Black land ownership, et cetera, as a way to say, you know, we know that historically you've been marginalized for this, and that is why there's this gap here. Here's a pot of money set aside. Again, not necessarily a one-to-one, like your family as a descendant, but more as a member of this community that we know has been sidelined. Here's a way to kind of enter back into the politics and economic, you know, cycle of the community through housing, through land development, through jobs, et cetera. So those are just two examples off the top of my head. But I do think that, you know, universities writ large are now grappling more seriously with, you know, the role that either actual slaves or money from made from enslavement has created. And also then we see kind of, like we said, what we call more symbolic, but equally important measures like the taking down of buildings or monuments that are dedicated to slaveholders and changing the names of those things and also putting up monuments to those who were enslaved. And those are all kind of the range of things we could think about in terms of reparations, because reparations is not necessarily just about payment, but it's also about repair.
No, absolutely. My own university, where my office is, was named the Von Kleinsmith Center at the University of Southern California. And for years, we had known that his research was extremely problematic. He was actually well-versed in eugenics. And so as a result of the killing of George Floyd and protests that came out of this, the university finally decided to change its name, chose an indigenous representative, Joseph Medicine Crow, to name the building after. But the irony being, we've all said, it's wonderful it's named after that. Let's hope they actually teach indigenous politics in that building. So that would be a practical issue. That was a bit of a tangent on that. Being an international relations scholar, I'm particularly fascinated in looking over your work. The emphasis on civil rights has had a tendency to focus on the United States as a bit of an exceptional case. But you have examples of a much more global approach. I think of civil rights and African decolonization and empowerment, et cetera. There's some obvious connections. How much did women contribute to the global scale and the global connections between Africa, former slaves, and other places like in Latin America, as well as here in the United States?
So I think something that's important to emphasize kind of about Black liberation struggles writ large is that they're always global in scope because you had to be. And there's two reasons you have to be. One is that, you know, the United States as an imperialist entity is a behemoth. And so international pressure, particularly because the United States likes to present itself as kind of a champion of global democracy and justice, is a key way to kind of compel the US government to make good on their actions. And then secondly, too, if you want to organize yourself outside the confines of a nation state that really truthfully was designed and built on your exclusion, you need other models and other forms of community. And that's where the international kind of Black global community comes in. So that's always been the case. And also the fact that Black people the world over have experienced some form of slavery or colonialism or neocolonialism, right? And so there's a linked fate in that idea that Black people carry on. But specifically in the 1960s and 70s, you know, this takes on an interesting bent. Probably most importantly, because it is a moment when people are watching the decolonization of Africa in real time. Right. So if you're somebody calling out for Black power and talking about Black people organizing and governing Black people for the first time, you're really watching this happen. It really is a moment when you feel like a different world is really possible. I mean, you're really seeking connections with those people. You want to see what that's like. You want to try to build those similar connections here, et cetera. And so what we see during civil rights and Black power, particularly among Black women, is, oh, and then the final thing I'll say that is a key to this is the desegregation of transportation and the lowering of cost of transportation. So this allows for the first time, you know, Black people and particularly Black women to go abroad and travel in a really different way and see some of these places firsthand. So all of that coming together means that there is kind of this global network of Black women activists that are organizing across the world, but particularly in African, free African countries. So some of them choose to be part of the expat community. There were African nation states such as Tanzania that actively called on Black Americans to come and build, you know, the post kind of colonial state. So we see organizers go there. We also see the Black women participate in what are now these sets of international congresses and meetings. And these international congresses and meetings are all are from Black people from around the world, particularly, but not exclusively, in the liberated countries of Africa, saying, we're now facing a new moment. What is our path forward? And these Black women in particular want to make sure that their beliefs, their priorities, their positionality, their troubles are not lost. So we see people going to things like the All Africa Women's Conference in 1972. We see Black women going to the 6th Pan-African Congress in 1974, and a bevy of other informal congresses and groups. And so it really was a moment where you got to commune with Black people from all over the world in a really different way, and also with leaders of nation states in a different way. And so it was very exciting for them, and they really took advantage of that.
It seems like probably true in political progress, social justice, across the spectrum, that this, the observation of two steps forward, one step back, or two step forward, then major backlash as a result of those two steps forward. Certainly in the case of racial equality, of gender equality, civil rights, we've seen this pattern historically, and we're experiencing one right now with, you know, quite a bit of backlash. So I guess first, the backlash of the railing against critical race theory and the way in which history, you know, courses are taught. How typical is this of backlashes from progress, and how have progressives, you know, how have those who have advanced these issues generally confronted the backlash?
The punishment for Black progress is always white backlash. That is, any student of history understands that. And, we could have predicted that this would happen, you know, a couple of years after kind of the risings of kind of the George Floyd era. There's a couple of ways that progressives and radicals really think about this. One is to really just understand it in the longer arc of history, right? When you understand that this is the cycle that we're in, but that doesn't mean that the cycle doesn't both move forward, but also look different, right? It doesn't feel so new. And when it doesn't feel so new, you know that you can survive it. And you can also look to previous history, historical moments for toolkits, right? Before, you know, critical race theory was multiculturalism was the issue, right? And before there was something else. So, you know, the playbook is somewhat historically specific, but the systems of oppression remain, right? How they're manifest in that particular moment changes, but the systems of oppression remain. And there is nothing, I think, that history, particularly history of marginalized peoples, teaches you better than that. So that's, you know, everybody wants kind of a toolkit. Looking in the past, efforts are one way to do that. But there's a couple ways also that I think are very instructive from the civil rights era. One of them is just to understand that, like, you know, folks are going to be targeted, right? And the targeting, of course, is never really about what that person is doing, for example, me teaching Black history, but more the visibility and kind of giving a face to a problem that people think that we have. So they were prepared for that by having kind of defense funds, petitions, et cetera, ready to go, kind of the stay ready so you don't have to get ready. They knew what kind of attacks were coming, and they were ready for that. The second is, you know, was the use of the Freedom School, right? We can and should continue to fight these repressive laws in our classrooms, but just because someone says that you can't teach in the classroom is not the be all end all of disseminating this information. And so, if you take back to say the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they knew that people weren't getting basic kind of citizen classes or Black history classes in the, you know, in Mississippi. Instead of saying, let's put those in the school, they just created their own, you know, kind of extra classrooms that were not governed in the same ways to get that information across. And that really created a groundswell of educated masses that really transformed what Mississippian voting looked like. So I think that we should be ready, and I mean, many people are already doing this, maybe a better solution is to say we should amplify those who are already doing this work and see how we can all contribute in that way as well. But, you know, we knew this was coming.
And speaking of amplification, after the realization of structural racism in the classroom, best defined by just having an awfully white syllabus. My gut reaction, you know, as an educator, as an academic, is I need to build my reading list. So in the spirit of that, who would you suggest other than, you know, of course, we're going to suggest to all of the listeners that they read your work, which is just fabulous work. Who are some of the authors that we should be reading to expand our understanding of these issues and expand our reading list, expand our syllabus?
So I want to go back to Ella Baker. I think Barbara Ransby's biography of Ella Baker and the radical democratic freedom struggle is both a biography of Baker, but also really an organizing manual through her analysis of how Baker organized. So I think that that is, can't be beat in terms of a great place to start. If you're looking to learn more about, some of these big groups from the era, like the Black Panther Party, Robin Spencer, who works at CUNY, I think, has a wonderful book about women in Black power in the Black Panther Party in Oakland. I want to uplift, one of the things that's really cool about this period of time is that most of these folks are still around, right? And no one more so than Angela Davis, who is prolific in her own right, right? She constantly, she has a great book called Freedom is a Constant Struggle, which is just a collection of her essays that I think is good. There's Abolition Feminism Now, which recently came out, which is also great. So I think, you know, there's no need to not listen to those who have been through some of the most repressive and difficult aspects of what we're experiencing now as for guidance to that. I think also, let's see, who else do I want to say? I think that the work of, if you're kind of moving kind of in the cultural realm, Imani Perry is especially interesting to look at. So she has wonderful biographies of folks that were active in the civil rights movement, but also cultural workers like Lorraine Hansberry. But she also got like a great book about the National Negro Anthem, Lift Every Voice, which helps you understand how the confluence of culture and civil rights comes together. And Imani is a beautiful writer. I think if you're really interested in learning about kind of the economic aspects of inequality and kind of how we got here today, I think Kianga Yamada Taylor's book, most recent book, just two, is key. And then she also, in addition to having the first book, is also has a book in which she addresses the Combahee River Collective. And the Combahee River Collective is a Black feminist collective that developed in the 1970s. And although they did not coin the term intersectionality, that came later with Kimberle Crenshaw, their manifesto or their statement was one of the first ones to really lay out what we mean when we talk about intersecting forms of oppression. So that book not only gives the overview of the Combahee River Collective and the statement, but it's wonderful because it actually has conversations with the members of the collective, which are still around. How We Get Free is the name of that book. I'm slipping my mind for a moment. So yeah, so those are just a couple of things off the top of my head. But I mean, one of the things that is, I think, really great about being an historian in this period is that we really are in a renaissance of kind of Black women's writings and uncovering all the different ways in which Black women contributed to this history. So any one of those is a great entry point. And then, you know, from there, I'm sure you'll find many more.
And I will suggest two others. One is Remaking Black Power, How Black Women Transformed an Era, with a wonderful author, Ashley Farmer, and new perspectives on the Black intellectual tradition. And of course, the Black Power series is just, you know, a wonderful series in, you know, in raising these issues. So thank you for raising, you know, raising the issues, raising our awareness of these areas. We've been talking about the empowerment of Black women, the role that Black women have played in the civil rights movement, the civil rights era, and Black empowerment, and addressing issues of white supremacy, and discussing some of the most important voices that unfortunately you may not have read, but hopefully you will very soon. Our guest has been Ashley Farmer. She is the Associate Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies and History at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you very much for joining us.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian.
Can worker-owned cooperatives transform workers' lives and livelihoods? With us is Jessica Gordon-Nembhard. Jessica Gordon-Nembhard is a professor of community justice and social economic development at the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College of the City University of New York. She's director of the McNair Post-Baccalaureate Achievement Program. Her latest book is Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Jessica Gordon-Nembhard. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you very much.
Very excited about your work, your study of cooperatives, cooperative economies, and history within the United States in particular. I thought we should start with somebody that you cited, which was W.E.B. Du Bois' theory. Could you give us an idea of what that theory is exactly?
I'm actually still struggling with how best to talk about it. But basically, Du Bois argued that because African Americans were more than just marginalized, but were sort of the lowest of the low on the economic totem pole, were pretty much left out of mainstream economics, were discriminated against in all the markets, we needed to do something a little different. And that is to kind of turn inward a little bit, use what he called voluntary segregation, or what most of us talk about as solidarity economics, or even black nationalism, in terms of looking into the group itself and creating a group economy based on cooperative economics that would really make sure to deliver all the goods and services and deliver the kind of economy that would help make the whole black community prosperous and that would get us out of the oppressive system that we were in. He's got lots of great quotes, but one is about how we can use intelligent economic cooperation to enter the new city as men and women and not mules, meaning. And the new city for him was, this is at the turn of the century, he's talking about how industrialization is really going to take off and new forms of industrialization are going to be the way to prosperity, and that African Americans can use cooperative ownership and cooperative democratic forms of economics to actually propel us in a position to be on equal, if not to exceed what the mainstream U.S. capitalist economy is doing, and stop being the mules of the economy and the mules of the society and actually be the intellectual economic leaders. So it's kind of very exciting. He has another quote about being at the forefront of industrial development and even another quote about how co-ops are going to help us to insulate ourselves and isolate and insulate ourselves and form a strong economic phalanx of prosperity and economic stability, so that we can't be harmed by these other forces. So it's an interesting notion about how a group of people with a common interest, in this case, class and race, can come together and use democratic cooperative economics to both our economic needs, but also to help propel us into a new and better economic system that would really help everybody.
One of the things that I find most compelling about cooperative economics is the idea of democratic workplace and the idea that it's participatory, where people actually get to make decisions together, one person, one vote, and then they share in the proceeds of it so that it's more egalitarian than a standard corporate model.
Absolutely.
So can you give us a little bit of background in terms of how these have actually worked? I'm mostly interested in the worker-owned co-ops, but I know you've studied many different forms of cooperatives. Can you kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of how these, in a practical way, work?
Even though I've been studying all different kinds of cooperative ownership, I've focused on worker co-ops whenever I could because I really think that they're one of our most important structures and one of the best ways, as you say, to democratize capital and to really have widespread economic participation and ownership and real democracy in our economic relations. So I have studied particularly late 20th century and 21st century worker-owned co-ops, often among people of color, but not always among people of color. And I even have done some work specifically about women of color, particularly black women, in worker co-ops. And what we're finding is that worker co-ops, especially the ones that have actually been part of social mission and a social enterprise model, which would be ones like Cooperative Home Care Associates in the South Bronx of New York City, or Mandela Food Co-op in, I think it's Western Oakland in California, or some of the sewing co-ops that have been in the South. There were two in North Carolina. There's some catering co-op, and childcare co-ops and babysitting co-ops. what we're finding with these worker co-ops is that they're able to take often very low-wage jobs that we wouldn't consider good. Like when we talk about a good job, right, we mean it pretty much has a living wage. You have benefits like vacation time, sick leave, sometimes retirement benefits. You also have the ability to move up in the job, so job ladder success. So these worker co-ops have been able to take industries and businesses that normally don't do that, like home care normally doesn't even give its employees full-time work because, you know, often they're just piecing together. You might be working for an elderly couple 5 hours a day, 3 or 4 times a week, but that's not really full-time work. It doesn't usually pay a living wage. It has no benefits, et cetera. So Cooperative Home Care Associates, for example, has taken that work and done two things at the same time. The first thing is they've raised the quality of the job, but partly they've done that by raising the quality of the work. So they also have an arm that does specified training so that all of their worker owners go through the same high-quality training so they can make sure that they're giving the kind of quality work that deserves the kind of quality pay and benefits and things that they want. They're also able to piece together full-time work for women, even if it ends up that they have to work in two different people's homes. But they pull together the work so that women have full-time jobs. They also pay living wages. The members get retirement funds. They are able to give back dividends because they're a profitable business. So, and most worker co-ops are for profit, so that they actually have profits or surplus at the end that can then be divided between going back into the business and being given back to the members as dividends. So some years the women have made 25% of their initial investment in the company back in 1 year. So that they have an investment, an asset, as well as a really good job, as well as high-level training. And then they also have ability to move up in the organization. They can move from the lowest level of home care to get higher credentials in nursing. They can move over into the training arm of the company. They can move up into the management part of the company. Sort of like the old days, they can sort of stay in the business almost forever or for a long period of time because they don't get stuck in the lowest wage job or that kind of thing. And the other thing that Chaka in particular was able to do was they actually lobbied the state and city government to reallocate Medicare money to pay for home care, which was one of the ways to up the wages for the whole industry so that when they had their living wages, they were more competitive in the industry. And we see that with some of the other groups, though not quite as successfully. Say the same thing in child care, right? Raising the quality of child care work because the women own their own company. They pay attention to high quality training. They're paid a living wage. They work well with the parents. They own part of the company. So if there are profits and surplus, they can get that back as extra, you know, return on their investment. They develop leadership skills, and so they assert themselves more in their own families, in their own communities, even on the job. A lot of these worker-owned companies are also unionized, and the union really either or both helps them to provide some of the benefits like health benefits and things, and also helps them to remember that they're owners and workers. And so how do they pay attention to the issues as workers? The union helps them do that, and then the board meetings and other parts of the company help to remind us their owners and that they can make other kinds of decisions also. And so it's an interesting collaboration. As you sort of said, it's kind of the best of both worlds. I believe it's a way to both raise the dignity of work as well as build assets. And then I really think the leadership development and the other social skills and social capital that gets developed is almost just as important as the finance capital they're able to gain.
If we contrast and actually fit this into larger economic questions and larger economic structures, one of the things I've been thinking about is that we've seen the world move into this sort of neoliberal age where increasingly the labor is contracted out, wages have been forced down because there's a competition for them.
Unions have been busted.
And unions have been busted, right. And so there's been, on one side, this move towards this competitive environment versus the co-op. But I wonder, in the shape of a neoliberal economy, which seems to be nearly global at this stage, how do these fit in? Are they proliferating? Can they become entire communities of cooperatives that work together? Or are they eventually going to get drowned out by a neoliberal economy?
The first thing, let me just put on the table, is while we're definitely seeing this deunionization and kind of commodifying of work and making work worse, but also having less people have even access to jobs. So that's one movement and theme that's happening in this neoliberal world. There also is a movement in the multinationals and a lot of the corporations that are actually democratizing their workplaces more because they're realizing that they're more productive. They can get higher rates of production out of employees who actually are given more responsibility, respect, and ability to work together. So there's a lot more of these quality circles and labor management boards and things. And a lot of the most profitable multinational companies actually practice a somewhat of workplace democracy. The problem is they don't go far enough, right? So it's a weird thing. In some ways, capitalism is still thriving because it has appropriated some of the best practices of having workers have a say and work together and that kind of thing. And yet at the same time, they're able to use that to oppress workers more, and especially in places like the U.S., reduce jobs and the quality of jobs. So it's a really weird or interesting, whichever way you want to look at it, tension. And I don't know exactly what we should do about that, except to say that I think in some ways I'm hopeful that even the neoliberal companies are in some ways moving more towards some other things. But the other thing that makes me hopeful, which is the second way I wanted to answer that, is to think about the move toward privatization and the ways that the co-op movement in Emilia-Romagna in Italy have handled that. And even though in the Emilia-Romagna region they've been privatizing and downsizing and things like that, the response, because they're from a very, I guess, liberal, progressive co-op region, has been to privatize toward cooperatives, right? In fact, worker co-ops, in fact, what we call social co-ops. And I'm very excited by that movement, and I do think that that kind of a movement can grow and should grow and will grow in the United States. So the social co-ops are worker-owned co-ops that provide social services in some way. So you could count teachers, but often it's counselors, psychologists, child care providers, drug rehabilitation workers, people in all those kinds of social services. And as the government started to privatize those services, instead of providing them through municipalities and government-owned agencies, the privatization, a lot of it happened as co-op development. For the Italian model, they also have another level of worker co-op, which is what they call Type B. And that's where the social service worker, as part of the therapy for the mentally challenged, for the disabled, for the recovering addicts, they actually help some of their clients to create worker co-ops as part of the therapy and part of the ways to help them. So recovering addicts and returning citizens might be doing landscaping or tutoring or other kinds of small businesses that they're also owning as worker co-ops. And the final way I would answer it is I also think that one of the ways we have to approach this growing neoliberalism is to actually bring industry and manufacturing back to the U.S. And again, one of the ways we can do that is through worker co-ops.
You mentioned in one of your articles about plans that had been put forward in Jackson, Mississippi by the mayor Lumumba to create an entire cooperative economy. Can you describe how he saw that there? And then can you connect it also to maybe what happened in Detroit?
When Mayor Lumumba got elected, one of his platforms was to really change the economy so that everybody could work, but also the economy would be doing things that would help the community and solve community problems. And also, I think the mayors before him had started to privatize a lot of things like the waste management and the recycling and that kind of thing. So one idea he had was that he could do what the Italians did instead of just having them go to private, for-profit, sole proprietor companies. These services could be given or earned by worker co-ops that would be doing the recycling, doing the waste management, that kind of thing. And then he also wanted to help promote more worker ownership in general around Jackson, both to solve the unemployment, also to solve the low pay issue, and to kind of create a better, a more sustainable and stable, prosperous economy for Jackson. The first prong was actually education, so that 2014 Jackson Rising Conference was all about education. Its original plan was to educate about 5,000 Mississippians about what is a cooperative, how to start one, et cetera. So it was supposed to be a sort of massive training program that could then launch a whole citywide co-op incubation project. The second prong was this identifying the industries and sometimes even firms that could be transitioned into worker co-ops. So again, looking at the companies that had just been privatized that used to be city-owned, looking at businesses where the owner was ready to retire and had no one to turn the business over to, so thinking about succession plan and turning those over to their, and selling the business to the employees, that kind of thing. And I guess the third piece was, you know, political platform, to have enough of a groundswell of people who were supporting him. So the real kickoff was supposed to be this Jackson Rising Conference, which still happened even though he was dead by the time they put it on. And then that Jackson Rising would launch the rest of this program. And then the hope was that there would be at least the recycling co-op, I guess, that would be sort of the first of many that would take off. So a lot of momentum was lost because Lumumba died. But the conference did happen. Now, it didn't have 5,000 people, but it had about 600 people, which I think we all can fairly say was the largest cooperative conference of predominantly African Americans, maybe since the Young Negroes Cooperative League's first conference in 1930 or something. So significant conference, even though it didn't live up to its original plan. And Cooperation Jackson is the name of the group of some of Lumumba's followers and supporters who then regrouped themselves outside of the city government and now are doing urban farming. They're still trying to do the recycling co-op. They have a building called the Lumumba Community Center where they are doing education and have a co-op cafe. And I think they have one other project underway. It's gone much slower than they expected, but they're still trudging along and moving along. The connections with Detroit are the two cities probably have very similar issues. Detroit probably even worse than Jackson in terms of industries have basically left. Lots of people who actually were relatively skilled because they had worked in some skilled industries but now have no work at all. A lot of vacant properties. So Detroit, my understanding is, has a lot of informal urban farming going on and stuff. Lots of opportunity to kind of think about how to re-industrialize the city, particularly starting with small worker co-ops and moving out from there. I went to Detroit once or twice to talk to some of the food security movements and some of the co-op development centers there, and they're trying to connect to the urban farming and use the local produce that's coming out of the urban farming and then do co-op restaurants or community-owned restaurants. I've seen some groups also trying to get back the industrial centers so that these, what's it called, make-it centers, where young people and other people can share equipment to actually make things.
There seems to be from my reading, a growth in the number of cooperatives. Do you think that that is validated by real numbers when you do a larger look?
It's a little of both. What I would say is this. The co-op movement in general is actually constricting in some areas and growing in others. So there's definitely a constriction in some of the agricultural co-ops and some of the old co-ops, like the big granaries and things like that in Canada and the U.S. They've definitely been demutualizing. And even the credit unions, there's fewer in number, though there seem to be more members, even though there's fewer credit unions. But part of that is because the regulators have been forcing credit unions to close, so that's a whole other issue. But at the same time, certainly there's a market growth in worker co-ops and food co-ops. And I think because worker co-ops and food co-ops are innovative ways to solve immediate local economic problems. Also, we've been in pretty terrible economic times. You know, we had the greatest recession since the Great Depression, that kind of thing. So I think we're seeing that, at least on a more grassroots local level, the issues about food security and issues about creating better jobs, at least, as I said, in the social co-ops and the ecology seem to be really important. Worker co-ops are particularly growing among urban immigrant communities, often because they can't find other work, and so they're finding that working together solves a lot of things. We're seeing, as I said, industries that seem to be needed in the local community are being created by people who want to work together in co-ops, so those are the ecological ones. We're also seeing not just consumer food co-ops, but also food services. Right, so the bakeries, catering co-ops, even small-level ones, and then some co-op restaurants and things seem to be jumping up in New York City, Boston, some other areas. It's very different when you look at some of the older, more established co-ops, and then when you look at these younger, new models, smaller, more grassroots co-ops. And the growth is really in these younger, smaller, grassroots, worker-owned co-ops, as I said, that are really looking to solve a variety of problems and are being either created by people themselves who are coming together to do the work or by nonprofits and other community organizations that are really doing social entrepreneurship and social mission co-ops. That seems to be, I think, where the growth is. And I would say rightly so, because that's really where the needs are. So for me, it's exciting to see that co-ops are continuing to do what they've always done, identify needs and solve economic and social problems. And I see co-ops doing that in the U.S., so I'd like to see more, but at least they're doing it.
Jessica Gordon-Nembhard, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Gordon-Nembhard is a professor of community justice and social economic development at the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College of the City University of New York. She's director of the McNair Post-Baccalaureate Achievement Program. Her latest book is Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.